Hello, Red Femme listeners. You're here with Jen and Hannah, and today we're going to be talking about a phenomenon on the left where politics can start to evaporate your personality. Happens on the far left. It probably also starts to happen maybe in reformist, kind of centrist politics, in electoralism.
I also think it happens on the right. I just think it happens to people.
Okay.
Who get very political.
Well, we only have experience of it on the far left,
yeah.
But I think it's part of how, again, particularly far left things can become a bit cultish. And I suppose it's how reformist parties can become a bit tribal. But one of the effects of that is the loss of personality to politics. And I also just wanted to say something that I forgot to last week on the episode we did on the student protests in America that have now spread to the UK. Because I saw some people tweeting saying, oh, what's the point? The point of them is not to just create a hullabaloo or raise awareness or a ruckus. It's that students go and, well, in the past, would go and occupy a building, often management offices, and today they seem to be taking up public spaces, and you have demands on the university. Now, historically, that was not for pizza or super glue or whatever else. Like, it wasn't for you. It would be things that a university can do, like, you know, call for a ceasefire or twin with a university in Palestine and offer scholarships to people from Gaza. So the student occupation I was involved with in 2009 won some scholarships for students from Gaza. I think it was two.
Right.
Yeah. And it was funny when the application opened, people from all over the world applied.
Yeah, I remember you saying, you were like, no.
Yeah, and it was sad because they sort of tell you their sob story. And I just remember the guy that was going through the applications was really upset. And he was like, I just so wish I could give this, like, Midwestern mum who missed out on going to university the scholarship. She's just not from Gaza.
Yeah.
And that's the terms and conditions. But then we should have had an occupation for, like, Midwestern mums.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to make that clear. And, you know, usually they weren't asking for anything extraordinary in terms of beyond the university's help. But the thing is, with the marketization now of universities and the financialization of capital in general, I saw an exchange between some students at, I think, Sunny, S-U-N-Y.
Oh, right. What is that?
It's in California.
Yeah, I know it. I know the acronym, but I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
I don't know what it stands for.
Let's find out. State University of New York.
Oh, right. Okay, so not California. And their poor president, who seemed like a very reasonable man, was trying to say to them, you know, we don't get to decide actually where our investments go.
Yeah.
It will be shareholders sort of in the university's stock or like whatever kind of capital they've used to invest somewhere. Then the shareholders that invested in that and the board members that run that scheme would decide, not him and the other senior management. And he was trying, because the students were saying, we've given you our money, we want to make sure it's not funding the bombing of Gaza.
Yeah.
Which is also reasonable. And he just said, but we don't have any control over that. Because, you know, universities are businesses now. So they don't just have money in the bank anymore and then decide what to do with it directly, which might be an investment. Now, to make money, it's invested sort of into like, given to like a third party to then invest.
Yeah.
And then you don't necessarily have control over what that third party does.
Yeah.
So it's very complicated, but
yeah, I think people can lose their personalities when they're involved in politics. I think it presents a frame with which to see the world, and the stakes are very high and it feels all very important because it is. Someone said to me when I was young, you know, there are so many different ways you can attempt to change the world. Spirituality, careerism, but politics is the real way things are changed. And she was right. It is actually how things are changed meaningfully in the world is through politics. And it's kind of this intoxicating thing. There's this intrigue and drama to it. You get really pulled into it. And then people become obsessive. They start to see it as kind of their main and only life mission. And that becomes all that they're interested in, all that they want to talk about. And there's a flattening of the personality that takes place.
Yeah, it is definitely, or it can definitely be intoxicating. And it makes you feel like you're an actor. You're a minor actor, but on a very grand stage. And you're talking about these huge powers, which nation states are, right? More, some more than others. And talking about the decisions that they make and how that's impacted other nations. And you really feel like, because it's true that what you're considering here is like power and the annals of power.
Yeah.
And then you start to think, oh, you know, is me going to the bus strike and selling newspapers at it, how does that connect? It starts to make small acts feel like they can be part of a bigger current, which in turn is part of an ocean of currents that decides the world.
Yeah.
And I think that so you don't ever really feel like what you're doing is irrelevant until it starts to sort of fail on its own terms, say.
Yeah.
But I do think that I used to, when I was in the Socialist Workers' Party, I did start to notice that if I would ask people a question, they would start to give a political answer. It's like a geographical or historical answer. And my example is, I'll change his name to Dan. There was a young man who I sent to LSE and other, I was at LSE at the time, but other halls basically to put up posters for a certain election. So we were going like around the UCL halls. Anyway, we had a day of getting the bus to different halls of residences where students live to put up these posters. And he's actually a real character. Like, he did theatre studies at university before then going on to do a bit of a, and I'm sorry to drama students, but a bit of a more serious master's and PhD eventually on Israel-Palestine. And, you know, I just remember that he didn't ask a single question about me. Where, what are you studying? Where do you live? When did you join the SWP? And I think I asked him about 30 questions. Now, I do also know that men are often a bit disinterested in lesbians.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Maybe we could say women in general who they're not romantically interested in. Perhaps that was it. I don't know. But this was such an effect within the SWP that I think it was really due to an over investment in politics.
Mm.
And at one point, he was from Belgium, I said to him, oh, so what's your favourite Belgium food? Because I didn't know fucking anything about Belgium. I'd never been. I was like, what's the difference between that and France? Who knows? Like, I had no idea. And I remember him saying, traditionally in Belgium, we eat waffles. And he was just, and I was like, no, I didn't. But I wanted to know what your favourite food was.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if someone would say to me, oh, what's your favourite British food? I might well say, oh, Sunday roast dinner. And then I'd explain that this is what people have in on a Sunday afternoon. But I wouldn't start just giving a kind of general answer.
Yeah.
Because that's not what I asked, you know? I didn't ask, so what do Belgians eat? I wanted him, like his view, an individual one. And that's it. You can lose your individuality.
Yes.
And it's considered suspicious if you have too much personal subjectivity and individuality.
Yes, yeah. And then, it's basically cast suspicion on you. And, like, you might be allowed to, like, have a hobby or, like, an interest that that becomes kind of their personality.
You're allowed one.
You're allowed one thing,
and
yeah.
And it's considered a kind of source of fun. So, like, if you find out, like, I don't know, like, my friend Ross, like, he supported Chelsea. So it'd be like, oh, did you see the Chelsea game last night, Ross? And they'll have lost. So it becomes something you can rib someone about. But more than one thing about you is not considered.
Yeah.
And it's strange because I was someone at university that I did do politics, but I also was captain of the basketball team. I started the Film Society, which became the biggest society at the college. I was interested in so many other things. And it's partly why I was popular and knew lots of people. But it was always considered as if I was soft and sort of not serious about politics.
Yeah.
And I also used to have friends that like, you know, my flatmate was like head of the officer training corps in London, and I was president of the Stop the War Society, which again at Goldsmiths was a big thing. Like, we had the army band off campus, and it would pass unanimously every motion that we did for that. Like, it wasn't a controversy. It was a really, really anti-war university. But I just found, me and my flatmate just found it very funny.
Yeah.
That we were a bit like the odd couple in this way. Like, he was a man, he was straight, he votes Tory. I was like a wacky socialist who was in Stop the War. And actually, his read of things was very good. Like, when I stood for union election, he said, oh, they're not going to let you win. And I said, well, they can't stop me. And indeed, they didn't manage to stop me. But he understood, actually, the lay of the land very well.
Right.
And we both thought that Goldsmiths was a funny place where, you know, you could just dress like a maniac and no one batted an eyelid and, you know. But my point is that even though I was friends, I remember at LSE, with people in the JSOX, the Jewish Society, who were, some of them, pro-Israel.
Yeah.
Surprise. And again, it was sort of as if, like, you know, I remember a friend of mine, a girl called Harry, actually, slightly different spelling. She was in SVP, but she was also a feminist. And it was always, oh, she's left, she's a feminist. And she would say, oh, I haven't. They would say, oh, no, she's joined this other group. And I'd be like, no, she hasn't. She just sat next to them because they had two stalls and they had a chat about feminism. But it was this idea that if you weren't a sort of one-dimensional kind of headbanger, or you had other parts to your personality, I think it was understood that women, because women are considered to be all, you know, just very agreeable and easily led, that you'd eventually be led off somewhere by other politics, and that it wouldn't be your own doing, and it wouldn't have been the failures of the SWP or the socialist group to retain you and be convincing. And all the time, yeah, it was as if those other things that you were interested in were definitely marks against you, whereas I consider them pluses, because my understanding was I can have friends who are quite conservative or friends that are pro-Israel, and we can still have like a discussion about that without falling out. And also I value them for other reasons as well. And they always considered that it meant you're soft. It's like, no, it's actually that I'm hard, as in like I'm tough, as in like I'm not just convinced by someone because they have a difference of opinion, or that I feel the need to agree.
Yeah, I think women are considered subjective, emotional, these kinds of base emotions, mentally ill, easily led. Men are considered objective, logical, rational, that sort of thing. And so, yeah, as a woman involved in politics, involved in left-wing politics, it's always considered that you are going to be convinced by usually a man and ferreted away somewhere. I remember when I started asking questions about prostitution and transgenderism and a few other feminist issues in the socialist group I was around, there was a man who was a radical feminist ally who would come to some of our events sometimes, and it was like, well, you've been talking to Kyle. You must have been talking to Kyle. I know you've been talking to people. You've been talking to these people. And I think Kyle and I had one discussion about prostitution at an event, and I asked him some questions about his point of view, and I said, oh, yeah, I mostly agree with that. But I didn't have the man's phone number. We hadn't spoken. We weren't friendly at all. It was only after being accused several times of you've been ferreted away by Kyle that I found Kyle's contact details and called him and was like, what's this about? Why are people saying this? But it's never considered that you could have just a genuine change of an opinion. And no, I definitely noticed that as well. There was a particular woman in the socialist group I was around. And yeah, just completely flat, personalityless. And you know when you're having a conversation with someone, there's only so much you could say about yourself? So she did the opposite thing in that she asked me repeatedly questions about myself, what I was doing, whatever. But there's only so much you can talk about yourself at a certain point. You know, you need this kind of reciprocal conversation.
Yeah.
And so I would ask questions about her and what she was doing and her life and her family and her friends. And it was like getting blood from a stone. It was like there was nothing there. I think the most I got out of her was that her brother was getting married, and, you know, there was some fight in the family about the wedding. And that was all kind of the only thing that she ever said. So kind of when I would see her and I became, started to feel awkward just talking about myself, I would ask about her brother's wedding. But beyond that, I knew this woman for years. I can't say I knew a single thing about her. It was just completely flat.
Yeah. And what is wrong with talking? Like, I'm really interested in other people's opinions, especially if they're a bit different, because I want to develop my thought. I want to know the limitations of X theory or Y understanding. And if I'm wrong, I want to know, because I want to sharpen my analysis and I want to develop it.
Yeah.
As the times change or, yeah, social formations change or whatever. And I also want to sort of even know, I used to read the Financial Times. It was almost like I wanted to know what the enemy was thinking.
Yeah.
The Financial Times is actually very good. But, you know, yeah, it's a really odd thing. And it is just an understanding that people are one-dimensional, especially women. And I remember our student organisers. So this was a full-time adult that was in, someone in full-time employment that was an adult, usually in their late 20s or early 30s, and they would be the student organizer for all of the socialist worker student groups up and down the country, which is quite a big task because they were very big then. It was, yeah, the biggest force on the far left, really without a competitor. And I remember when I first joined, the first guy, again, like very flat personality, but it's also because they work you so hard.
Yes.
Like, yeah, 6-7 days a week. And I remember that he was on the central committee and he was actually told to take a break because he'd got so physically exhausted, he'd started to piss blood and he just needed to rest. So he was like, like they told him, you know, you need 2 weeks off. Anyway, he did have a French girlfriend and he eventually moved to France. I don't know what he's doing there now at all. But other than that, I didn't know anything about him. Nothing was ever kind of said. And then we had a student organizer who was a bit more of a quote unquote slave driver. And I remember people would say, oh, she's totally neglected her personal life. Like, I think her and her girlfriend broke up. She was not someone who, that was described to me, she's not the kind of person who goes home at the end of the day and has a cup of tea with their partner.
Right.
It was just everything was about the socialist group. And then the expectation for you was to also basically make life-changing decisions, like what university you go to, based on...
Oh, completely.
Yeah, based on the socialist groups, whether it would benefit them or not for you to be at X university. And it was quite a strange thing that obviously I just ignored because I thought, oh, that's balmy. But it was very present and not everyone did ignore it.
Yeah, no, not everyone did ignore it. And yeah, just the slave driving for sure. I remember the group that I was in, there was lots of people who worked in the trades. The trades are IT, but a lot of people, particularly the men who worked in the trades, and tradesmen start early in the morning, start 7 a.m., 6:30 a.m. starts is kind of the industry standard. And we'd be sat there working at something at 1 a.m. And I'm thinking, like, these people are going to have to be at work doing, like, manual labor in 4 or 5 hours. Like, this is just crazy.
Yeah. I remember my friend James. I mean, I don't know him anymore. We've lost touch. But he was, like, the other main SWIS person, Socialist Work Student Society person at university at one point, after other people had graduated. And I remember that he was asked to work in what they called the Marxism office, which really just meant two computers in an office that were allocated to the Marxism festival that summer, which was a festival of kind of ideas. Well, I say that, it's one idea. And it was their sort of, like a few days of lectures and workshops. And it was always very good. It was nice to kind of see people from around the country. And it was the level of thought that I was at the time. Obviously, now I would have major criticisms about almost every other workshop that was taking place. And of course, now it promotes postmodernism and trans and other forms of woke, unhinged, radical liberal politics. But at the time, it didn't at all. In fact, they used to argue about the problems with queer theory back in 2009-10. Anyway, James, who was a working class student from Croydon, which if anyone outside the UK needs to know, is regarded as a bit of a shithole. People make jokes about Croydon, right?
Yeah.
So he was like a proper working class young man, and he did his degree full time. He also worked on a fish counter in Asda. And I remember they asked him to work in the marketing office, but by work, obviously you don't get paid.
Mm.
And he said, oh yeah, I can do like 2 evenings a week. And then 2 evenings became every evening. And then it was, you need to be full time. And I just remember him on the phone, like kind of tearing his hair out to me saying, I just don't know how to do this. They've just said you need to forgo your wages for the next month because it's so vital that we have these numbers at the Marxism Festival this summer. And when you're in one of these organizations, they do almost say this to you as if it's the most important thing in the world.
Yeah.
Like as if this is just the difference between, you know, capitalist oppression and socialist freedom.
Yeah. And no, seriously, that is how they frame it.
Oh yeah, like I said, I don't understand how they can make that demand. But I know exactly what they would have said, which would have been, well, you know, this year, sorry, I'm doing the voice of the student organizer who was then in charge of the Marxism Festival in the summer when students weren't, you know, go home. Well, the thing is this year there's been a lot happening, the Egyptian Revolution, there's all this kind of sweet, you know, and the way they would put like, student rebellion on campus is growing. We need to get those people in. Like, they're people that we need to be, you know, putting out the line to, bringing them to the Marxism Festival, educating and radicalising them. There's been this strike in that part of the country, another strike in another part of the country. And they put it to you as if you were, like, missing out on a political opportunity.
Yeah.
And why would you take your labour away from that when you want a revolution, you know? So you start thinking, oh, God, yeah, maybe, you know, I do have to put more into this. Anyway, he capitulated and started working full time in the Marxism office for free and not doing his job at Asda for that month or whatever, or a couple of months, I think it was. And I remember at the festival in the summer, it was his birthday, and I had organized a picnic on the grass near SOAS. And, you know, I don't know, I'd been to Sainsbury's and bought picnic stuff, and I'd created a WhatsApp group of people to say, oh, you know, all 11 of us should be there, sort of his friends that were attending. And it got to like, I don't know, lunchtime that day, 1 p.m. And he said, oh, I'm not going to be able to come because I have to be on the reception desk giving out people's tickets, you know, or like checking their tickets when they come in and or whatever it is, you know. And I was like, but don't you get lunch off? And he was like, no, they've said I can't. And I went down there. It was the Institute of Education. And I went in and I was like, what the fuck is going on? And I tried to get an actually paid other organizer of some kind to say, like, can you, who's having a cigarette outside, can you just look after James's shift just for an hour so he can attend his own birthday picnic? And the guy was just like, oh, no, couldn't be asked.
Mm.
And I just went in and I was like, look, nothing's going to happen if you can't check people's tickets for an hour or, you know, give them the physical ticket if they've bought the online one or whatever it was you were doing. And I just physically took his hand and was like, we're going to your birthday picnic. And he was just laughing. And I was like, you can blame me. You can say I physically forced you. And we had the picnic. But I just, yeah, just this total, it's not even just disrespect, but complete unacknowledgement of the individual. That this guy had been denied having an hour off to go to his own birthday event.
Yeah.
That was just 2 minutes away.
Yeah.
And that he's entitled to a lunch surely anyway.
Mm.
And I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, you need to give workers the conditions that you want for them under socialism. But there is a point where it becomes a little bit hypocritical and insane.
Well, I think the idea is, we live in such times that are so non-revolutionary and, you know, we're so apolitical. People are so apolitical. At least this is how it was put to me. People are not radicalized. It's not in the forefront in people's mind. So you have, therefore, an extra responsibility to be doing more to try and, I don't know, promote these politics or whatever. And it's actually a kind of masochistic sort of virtue that you get by doing this, and maybe it won't be recognized in your time, but it will be recognized sometime in the future or something. But it, then, it, you know, I hate to sound like Judith Butler, but it just becomes like a performance for yourself. Indeed, and sometimes that's what it is, having meetings that you invite the public to and having only the people that you know show up and doing a bit of a performance for each other of something, it becomes incredibly performative, and it also becomes clear that this is like doing something psychologically for the people involved that have nothing to do with politics, really. And I do think, I think Gabor Mate said you can become addicted to politics, and I do think for many people it becomes a way to work out psychological problems. I think that analysis can be overused, and people use it as a way to dunk on their political enemies, to pathologize whatever they're saying, either direction, in a way to get like a win on them or whatever. But I think it's objectively true that often people get involved in these sorts of politics as a way to work out whatever's going on for them. And I think it's also, it becomes identity. It becomes, that's why I think we see the flattening of the personality. It becomes the person's identity. It becomes their motivation. It becomes the reason they get up in the morning. And I do think, for myself at least, to have a full life means having a political life. I can't imagine not being political in some way. I can't imagine not caring about the world around you. I can't imagine not acknowledging the reality that politics is really the most important force sort of in the world in terms of determining what happens in people's lives. But it's also very important to have a very strong grounding of identity aside from politics. And there isn't really an acknowledgement of it.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of people who had breakdowns after the split of the Socialist Workers' Party over the Comrade Delta rape scandals, basically. I remember the a friend of mine lost his voice for like a year. Mm. Another one, basically, he said he started drinking too much, and he eventually, he didn't lose his job, but he was on probation for a year and they didn't keep him on. And he said, it's partly to do with that. And then some of them, two men, literally lost their minds and then started identifying as women, have done the whole trans thing.
Right.
One of them, I saw a photo of him in a full, in a gold ball gown, in bright, like red high heels outside WH Smith's at 10 a.m. in the morning.
Right.
Just fully, you've lost your marbles.
Mm.
And just the, yeah, I think it was holding quite a lot of people psychologically together, that you can go from like a confident, or someone I thought was a confident, laddish young man, I think his girlfriend had said to me that he was a bit prone to depression, to then being so invested in a group and the theory that they propose, which is we're going to be the vanguard party that ushers in the revolution and is the sort of most radical section of the working class. But then when that vision that you've been sold crumbles, I mean, basically, yeah, his mind crumbled.
Yeah, I've been reading Joan Didion recently, and she met up with a young Marxist-Leninist, and this was in the 1960s, when there was obviously this explosion in left-wing politics, and there was these Marxist-Leninist groups that were tiny and irrelevant. And basically what she wrote about this particular man she was sort of interviewing and then analyzing was, and what she really highlighted in the piece was just how doomed his politics were and how he seemed to kind of be oblivious to it, or that it was a way of working out kind of an impending sense of doom. Sorry, I just have to find it so I can commentate on it properly. Yeah, so it's from Slouching Towards Bethlehem, her book, and it's, the piece is called Comrade Lasky, CPC, CPUSAML. And she says, as it happens, I'm comfortable with the Michael Latskys of the world, with those who live outside rather than in, those in whom the sense of dread is so acute that they turn to extreme and doomed commitments. I know something about dread myself and appreciate the elaborate systems with which some people manage to fill the void, appreciate all the opiates of the people, whether they are as accessible as alcohol and heroin and promiscuity or as hard to come by, as faith in God or history. And I think that's what it was to be so committed to such an obviously doomed project. And then at a certain point, I think it must have been different in the SWP, because the tendencies that I was involved with was much more Marxist-Leninist. They called themselves Trotskyists, but they weren't. They were much more Marxist-Leninists. That it's such a doomed project. It's so marginal. It's so on the sidelines. It's so not in the public consciousness that I think one goes into it hoping to recruit and build a movement, but eventually it just turns into, we are like an exclusive club and we have this doomed project, but there is something about, there's something virtuous about still aiming and striving and seeking towards resolving this conflict that is, and doing this project that is so obviously doomed.
Yeah.
And it's having that sense of like, this is so unrealistic, so ridiculous, so absurd, so alien and bizarre. It kind of puts doom right in your face.
Well, I think back in my day, there were more normal people involved in the far left, and the SUP did have people who were fully rounded human beings. And it would more be that you'd be assumed to be one-dimensional, and that meant great, in terms of you're just a one-dimensional political act for the party. And then as soon as you would say no to something, it was like you didn't really matter anymore. Like, can you, yeah, go to this university because we need someone there on campus? No. Can you do this event next Thursday? I need you to speak on climate change. I don't really know anything about that. And then it would be, okay, no, this person's not. Basically, as soon as you said no to one thing, it was kind of that you were written off. But I think today, since, given woke politics, given who that attracts, given that socialist groups have embraced that, they often attract people who really do want to almost adopt these politics as their personality rather than having one. And they're kind of okay with how doomed it is, because they're just getting off on the performative identity thing.
Yeah.
I'm a socialist, look at me, here I stand, even though it makes no difference whether I'm stood here on the street with this placard or not. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, the kind of thing where I started to notice in the decline of these socialist groups that they would be more okay with smaller and smaller protests. And I'd think, but that's not good. That shows that you're unpopular if only 9 of you turn up.
No, it shows how virtuous you are and how you're willing to be revolutionary in an unrevolutionary time.
I just find it so acutely embarrassing.
Yeah, no, they wouldn't. They would see it as a... And if you're embarrassed, it means that you're demoralized and that you're a moral failure and that you are not strong enough and you're weak and you want an easy life and you only want to be involved in politics when it's popular and you're ethically deranged and etc.
I mean, I think Jordan Peterson's right when he says that there is a depressive tilt on the left and then he says there's a paranoid tilt on the right. Mm. I think that's quite a good read, because I also never really understood why any of the students, this is the full-time paid adult in their late 20s and early 30s, would be really pessimistic when it would come to elections. Because I thought, if these ideas are correct, we should be confident about them. They'll carry in the public consciousness. We can win people to our ideas. And I remember, like, Manchester University in the time of kind of the Iraq War was such a stronghold for the SWP. But every year when they'd re-stand, they would be told, oh, you're not really standing to win. You're not going to win. You just need to have SWP propaganda all over your poster so that we recruit.
Yeah.
And then people would stand and win. And it was like, I remember standing and I was sort of not told the same at first. I think it was when I stood to be editor of a student newspaper. They said, oh, you need to have SWP stuff all over it so that if you don't win, we've still recruited. And I just said, no. I'm not having it. Like, I'm not standing as someone who's going to produce, like, Pravda. Was that the name of the,
yeah,
right, the communist newspaper of the Bolsheviks? Like, obviously, it's going to be a left-leaning paper, and I'm going to be honest about that. But it's just going to be a newspaper that still, you know, everyone would enjoy reading. Like, I'm not crazy. It will just be, I was explicit about it, will support the student movement. There you go. And my positions are I support things that are in students' material interests. And I remember stating my intention, and the student organiser said, oh, well, we're going to have a conversation about that. She was from Dudley, near Birmingham. And I thought, okay, I'm happy to have a conversation about it. But she was kind of making out as if I needed their permission. And I just thought, I don't need your permission for anything. But I didn't say that, right? Because again, if you started talking like that to people, you'd just be ousted.
Yeah.
You'd be probably expelled or whatever. So I just said, oh yeah, fine, I'll come into the office to have a conversation about it. And then we went to the kitchen, which was basically like not private at all, didn't even have a door. It was just adjacent to the office. And she just spoke to me like dog shit. She was just like, go on then, give us your pitch. It was just like, I'm not asking you, I don't need to pitch you.
Yeah.
If I want to do this, like, also it was a paid job. Like, if I don't do this, are you going to feed me? Like, so strange. I just went, well, I just think it would be quite good to have a left-wing editor of a newspaper that goes to 22 campuses across London and Paris. Like, why wouldn't you want that if you're a socialist group? Because it means that if you have something to advertise, you do a little advert for me, a little graphic, I'll probably put it in. Like, why would you not want those connections? And so in the end, she said, oh, well, we'll have to sign off on it every fortnight, because it would go out every fortnight. And I just agreed and said, yeah, okay, because I knew they weren't going to. It's like, are you really going to read 32 pages of a student newspaper? Like, you really think it's that big a deal? What, so I don't publish something that then the party, so self-important, the party will get in trouble for? No one cares.
Mm.
Like, the whole point about a newspaper is it isn't representing me or the party or whatever. It's representing, I suppose, the thoughts of whoever writes things. But also, it was mainly like a news section, a fashion section, music, poems, like a literature section. And there was like a sports page at the back. There wasn't, I think there was one politics page.
Well, the idea is that if it's an important project or if it's important to you or if you want to do it, it has to be subsumed into what the party wants. But what I find strange about that is that they're often, at least in my case, were so unserious sort of about what the conditions are at the moment and what young people are thinking, what people are reading online, what the currents are. It's like the right wing didn't exist. We never talked about what the right wing were thinking or saying or doing. We never talked about how basically the left and the right as a paradigm is sort of breaking down. I think it's really more globalism versus anti-globalism now is kind of the paradigm, really. And there was never any acknowledgement of any of that. And it was just like a weird attempt to recreate a situation or a political paradigm that no longer exists.
Yeah.
And it was like, and it was also because there was this sense of superiority on the inside, people who were involved, that people on the outside didn't need to be spoken to seriously. You didn't have to have actual like serious debates with them. In kind of dialogue with what they were reading around them or what people were saying around them or what the news was saying around them or what they were reading on Twitter. I remember, like, for example, on Syria, being against the war in Syria, being against drone strikes in Syria, and people would come to me and go, well, you're an Assadist, you know, you want to support Assad and you want to whatever. And it was like, at that time, I hadn't even considered that whole humanitarian interventionist argument, or only considered it very kind of in a shallow sort of way. And I didn't have very much of a response. And they were kind of treating me as if I was right wing, because a lot of the people who are against the war in Syria are right wing. And this sort of reality of this change in political paradigm was not really acknowledged. They would talk about things kind of in the course of history, but they would never talk about the battle of ideas in how it actually is today. And so much of it is about performing in a particular way and signaling kind of cultural signs of where you are in this left to right paradigm that basically, I'm afraid, doesn't really exist anymore in the same way it did.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think it did exist until the 2010s. So my time there
Right.
Was part of that. And then, but I think that has changed from the mid 2010s onwards.
Since Trump, basically.
Or even really from 2014.
Yeah.
I would say. And I think that they haven't caught up with that and they don't seem to have an interest in it. They want to pretend that there's still the old right and the old left.
Yes.
But now the old left, quote unquote, has decided to incorporate woke ideas and postmodernism because they still want to recruit young people because they have an existential crisis if they're not doing that.
Yeah.
And, but this is, you know, it is true. Like, the vast majority of these groups are over 60, often over 70 and 80,
yeah.
Which does mean that half, well, not just half, about 90% of their membership will literally physically die in the next 20 years.
Yeah, it's the same dynamics that happen within feminism. It's really not a political, like real feminism, not liberal feminism, but real feminists. There isn't really a push to recruit or build or be interested in what women are saying.
What young women are saying.
Or what young women are saying.
No, I mean, they have a much worse recruitment, quote unquote, crisis. As in they're against it.
Yeah, they don't want it.
Whereas the left, the far left, will adopt new in vogue ideas. And let's be honest, it's Trotskyism, it's opportunism.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's the Marxist-Leninists don't do that. Trotskyists absolutely do. And I think that's a tendency from Trotsky, I suppose. But I think it's much worse than it was at the time and in the past. But I find, yeah, it's interesting that those ideas are incorporated because they essentially sort of see that they're so popular.
Mm.
But and they're not seen just as an affront. But they did argue for years against queer theory. Not very much.
Mm.
But it's just when gay stuff came up, which was rarely.
Right.
They would say, this is our opposition. And it wasn't a very good opposition because they're not willing to talk about women.
Right.
Or children's rights.
Yeah.
And really have an argument that has teeth.
Mm.
And so, of course, they capitulated eventually.
Yeah.
And they still put it, they still say the same stupid things like, we support trans rights because trans people are part of the working class. And therefore, we want as many sections of the working class involved in class struggle. But it's like, actually, that can't be the case if you then see that what trans politics does is it cannibalizes left-wing organizations to the point they just implode.
Well, even if we were to take that at its word and say, yes, transgenderism is like a working class issue or a thing that working class people care about, I think that's, to begin with, it really started off as a very bourgeois thing in universities, in coastal liberal communities. That's where it was. We're starting to see it filter down more to working class girls, basically, who are doing the transitioning now that it has become less cool among the bourgeois class. But let's just take it at its word and say, yeah, this is what working class love. They love, you know, chopping off the breasts of teenagers and inverting penises of little gay boys, and that's what they really like or whatever. These are the same people who can acknowledge that the working class has totally reactionary views on race and on other issues. And I don't see transgenderism as any different. It's entirely reactionary, anti-woman, anti-feminist politics. Yeah. It is completely irreconcilable with any feminist principle that exists.
Well, they don't incorporate feminism when women are half of the working
exactly,
class.
Exactly, yeah.
The truckers' strike in Canada,
I know.
They, in order to justify why they didn't support them, they had to call them fascists.
Yeah.
Do you think there's tens of thousands of fascist truck drivers in Canada?
Or they said they're not workers because they own their trucks and then they work on a contract basis with these companies, so they're not really, I mean, that was literally the workers seizing the means of production. Like, there isn't another way to like look at that or think about that. And I think it's probably the biggest Canadian contribution to world history. I think that there was a time before and after the trucker protests in terms of COVID. The trajectory completely changed after that event. We don't have vaccine passports now. We don't have all the draconian anti-democratic measures that they were wanting to take after those trucker protests. I'm of the opinion that it ended it. They shut down trade between two major countries. And the Communist Party of Canada came out against it and said that they were fascists.
It's just crazy. That's exactly what the socialist groups here did.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I mean, they literally did seize the means of production. This idea of shutting down trade, like, there's this idea that, you know, if you could get all the workers in ports across the world to go on strike, you could shut down the world.
I mean, the Canadian economy is something like 16% American. So they shut down an economy, they shut down the trade routes between a major trading partner, shut down the Canadian economy for a period of time, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's just crazy that they just will not adapt their ideas. But there was, yeah, there was always this narrowing of not just ideas, but yeah, so the person, the personhood was like you were narrowed subjectively. But then also, yeah, I mean, I suppose it's just fear of, I don't know why they wouldn't want to have these arguments or discussions, because to me, that's what I find interesting about politics.
Yeah.
And these new sort of, not exactly innovative, but these new formations that happen are exactly like, that's what's interesting. I don't just want to talk about 1917 on repeat all the time.
Yeah.
And pretend that any of that, you know, what's, you know, and it's such a shame. I get it. Like, I have the nostalgia thing as well. And I think that 1917 in Russia was great, but it's sort of like, again, two people I knew that were in the SWP, they went 100 years after to the train station where Lenin got off the train before he did his Lenin getting off the train speech before the October Revolution. He came back and reignited it all, basically. They went to, as if greet him, his ghost, 100 years on. There was no one else there.
Yeah.
Your scope of thought, your scope of how you think about people and what they're allowed to be, they're not allowed to be multidimensional. And then you also don't keep up with anyone who has a sort of leg in politics and a leg outside. Why wouldn't you start to no longer understand the outside world properly and still be pushing the same line you pushed in 2003? Like, a lot of the time I'll tune into something about, I don't know, American imperialism, and the person speaking will be talking as if 9/11 just happened.
Yeah.
Or we're invading Iraq in 2003.
Yeah.
And I sort of want to comment and be like, well, look, the American empire is in decline. None of this is happening anymore. It's not going to happen. They don't have the money. Like, they're not going to go to war with Iran because they would lose, and they know. Like, guys, like, but it's just, they're just not in touch.
No. And there's not a lot that fills that gap at the minute at all.
No, there isn't. There's a guy on Twitter. Let me give a shout out to him.
Is it the Marxist-Leninist Institute or whatever it is?
Yes, that's it. Thank you.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's what he calls himself.
Okay.
He's very good. He does lives. He has a Patreon where he does some basically podcasts, but he does sort of video as well. His analysis is very good. If anyone far left is listening that fancies a listen.
Yeah.
It's so refreshing.
Yeah, it's very.
I'm like, my God, an actual Marxist analysis.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, being addicted to crack and then not being able to find crack for 5 months. And you're like, oh, I finally found some crack behind this garbage bin or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that it's true that, like, old school Marxism or old school socialism, the old left, there is a failure in that we're talking about people's personalities becoming flattened as they get involved in politics. There is a failure, I think, to speak to people's subjectivity, to their experiences, to their feelings. What the left has done with what when the left attempted to do that, what we got was postmodernism, basically, and queer theory and critical theory and all these things that are so counter-revolutionary and anti-working class and anti-women and anti-gay people and everything else. And I think that there is not really a way in those political spaces to reach people in a way that is personal and meaningful and speaks to their experience. I remember speaking to someone in a Marxist-Leninist group, and he said, we were talking about something to do with economics. I think we had just taken a class on particular Marxist economic theory. And he said, oh, well, you know, you don't really need to know this stuff. If you're a working class person, you'll just get it. You'll just understand it. It's your life. And I remember thinking that that's their kind of only claim to the personal, to the subjective, to people's feelings. And I think the popularity of wokeism or critical theory or, you know, postmodernism, whatever we want to call it, is a response to that reality, that there isn't something that speaks to people in a very personal way. I mean, like Ben Shapiro says, facts don't care about your feelings. And then people in response will say, well, feelings don't care about your facts. And there isn't a lot that speaks to this subjectivity. I think we can look at like the very early kind of Frankfurt School people. And there was some good stuff that was written. I think people write that stuff off much more quickly than they need to. But as far as speaking to people's real, the things that are important to them, I think this is also a right-wing criticism that people have of the left. Like C.S. Lewis, I think, in the Screwtape Letters, he said, if you ask me what's important to me, what really is like the most important things to me, it's not going to be something about that's material, that's about economics, something that really speaks to my heart and my soul. It's beauty, it's aesthetics, it's these kind of universal values. And I think that postmodernism was an attempt to create something like that, but it's just completely failed and instead created this sort of artifice of a person where people go, well, I'm going to do this performance of sort of suffering where I'm a Black, trans, marginalized, disabled. Mentally ill, neurodivergent person, look at my suffering. But there isn't a real, and from the old left, I think there was a failure to speak to people's subjectivity. And I think it could be because, you know, there was this anti-individualism, which frankly, I agree with. I think that I agree that the more you think about yourself, the more miserable you are, actually. And I think that individualism becomes a cul-de-sac and becomes a problem quite quickly. But because of that, there wasn't an appreciation of people's subjective experiences.
Yeah, postmodernism and its ilk definitely overcorrected, but they only could do that because the space was there because of the failures of the real left.
Yeah.
Because I'm also very interested, in boring, turgid Marxism.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time when I'm talking about politics, I'm not really interested in, say, people's, I don't know, individual claims to, as you say, these different demographics. I want to talk about those demographics as they are.
Yeah.
And then how structures exist and how structures interrelate. But I also, though, in just my general interactions with people in politics, whether that's political work or generally, I don't want it to be fully ignored that I have more to me than just politics. Mm. And I don't want it to be cast suspicion upon,
yeah,
which is what happens. And I find that they would really sort of chase people away with it. So eventually my friend James left the party before the rape scandal stuff.
Right.
Because of course. Yeah. And they probably justified it saying, oh, well, most people we recruit students leave. But he was really dedicated. He worked for you for free for 3 months. Obviously, he was on board. But they sort of chase people away by kind of not giving a shit about them or sort of beating them with a big stick about other things. Like, I remember another time I was trying to say no to the student organizer and she turned around and said to me, oh, that was it, just to say for the student editorship, they made me put on my poster active socialist. That was the compromise we got to. I was like, I'm not having the fucking SWP on there. But they made me put active socialist, which I thought was quite funny because imagine if I put inactive socialist. Like, what other kind is there, really? Anyway, I mean, it made no difference. But I remember in one of these elections, she said to me, oh, you only got elected because of the party? And I was like, sorry? What? I was like, I got elected despite being in the SWP. She was like, oh, but we came and campaigned for you. And I was like, oh, well, thank you for 8 of your campaigners. I had 44 people campaigning for me. The Drama Society, the Christian Society, the ISOC, the this, that, and the other, the Netball Girls. Like, what are you talking about? It was like, I managed this. People are like, Jen's in the SWP or Jen's a socialist. And then they caveat that with, but she's okay.
Right.
And I'd have loads of people that would be really shocked that I was in that group because they'd be like, oh, I just didn't think you would be. And actually, I look back now and it's because I was cool. It was because I dressed in a hipstery kind of way. It was because I went out sort of gay clubbing. It was because I had other things to my personality. And when they met those people, that was all they were, and that was all they did. And I just thought, like, what topsy-turvy world do you live in that you think that I should be like grateful to you or have gratitude when it should really be the other way around? Like, now I can do stuff for you because I'm in a certain position, maybe. But it's also like, you've got to be fucking nice to me. Like, for God's sake, like, it's such a basic thing. Like, at least just be polite to me. It's not even nice, just politeness. Like, I remember around the Comrade Delta rape scandal stuff, I had a full-time position in the University of London Union. It doesn't exist anymore. And its shorter name was ULU. It's next to UCL, the building that remains still. And they wanted to book a room there. And of course, they couldn't, but I could. So I said, oh yeah, I'll book a room there. And I think it was even to discuss this big hullabaloo going on, or maybe it was an event that they had that was public facing, I don't know. Anyway, some woman had like seen my comments on Facebook about like, how did this happen, last year, and how did we not sort this out internally about the rape scandal, right, of Martin Smith sexually abusing two teenage girls. And this woman rang me and sort of had a go at me and was really horrible to me. And I didn't stand up for myself properly because, again, you always feel like you can't. And I remember I got off the phone and another student involved with the paper said, oh my God, being in the SWP is like being in North Korea. And I was like, yeah. And I cancelled their room booking. Because it was like, you can either treat me like shit and I won't do anything for you, or you can be polite to me and then maybe I'll do things for you. But you can't treat me like shit and then also have me as your skivvy. What? And I just cancelled it. Anyway, apparently they turned up and were allowed the room anyway because it was just free and it had been on the register. But it was just so incredible, like the sort of length that they thought they had with you, like that it would just, that your tolerance for this kind of stuff would go on and on forever and ever. And the woman basically rang me because she felt guilty because she was trying to support these young women that had been abused. And then, but basically done a crap job at it. And she sort of said, oh, well, you were at that conference. Why don't you do anything? And I said, well, I didn't know anything about it. And that was the first I'd ever heard of it. And they made out as if he had like a saucy affair. I didn't know it was sexual abuse. And you did, and you didn't do anything about it, and you should have. And but yeah, just the what that sort of being spoken to you like that, I just thought, well, fuck you then, I'm cancelling your meeting. So that's the thing, they erode your goodwill. There's only so much you can be treated like a kind of peasant.
Yeah, it's true. Oh, it's so true. You come to a point where you can't take it. And it wouldn't take a lot, actually. It just takes a bit of like politeness, being normal, like normal working hours.
Just even this most bizarre experience I had that near the SWP office, at the time it was in Vauxhall, I don't know where it is now. And I was told, oh, you need to go and pick up some banners or papers, and we don't keep them all here because we wouldn't have room. And it was like they rented a cellar nearby. And I'm not kidding, I went into the cellar and there were like three dwarves. Three dwarf members that were there. And I was like, oh, I've never met you before. And I was like, oh, and they gave me the stuff. And I remember being like, are you hidden? I didn't say this, but I was like, are you hidden here? I know, like, so, it was so dark. And I was like, they keep some dwarves in a cellar. No, but like, was just like, what the fuck is this? And it was like dark down there and like not a nice place. And I just remember thinking, like, what is this? Like, where, what have I stepped into? And I think I just, like, me and whoever was with me took the placards and we're just going, oh, we've never met them before. Are they like full members? Like, why are they at Marxism Festival?
They'd be half members.
No. No, but I just meant like, are they active, like full-timers, or are they really in the party? Because I'd never seen them at the Marxism Festival. And I was like, are they ashamed of our dwarves? I was like, there's nothing to be ashamed of.
We're sorry, that was a very cancel. We're gonna get cancelled for that joke.
Very good joke. But it was just like, I didn't understand at all. Like, why was like, what are their names? Why has no one ever told us about them? Like, if they're full-time employees, why aren't they around the office? Why do they keep them in the cellar? I was a bit concerned. Like, do they live down there? Do they feed them properly? What's going on? Is this a magical story tale now? Like, and I just there would you'd have genuinely like maybe just every month or every other month a really bizarre experience where they're this like, okay, is there's a taboo in the party that if well, I don't even know what's the proper word for dwarf.
Little person, I
Well,
think.
that's patronizing and weird. Is that really it?
I think that was the PC term for a while. I mean, person with dwarfism.
Okay, person with dwarfism. If we have people with dwarfism, you can't just make them like work in the back of the shop
No.
as if there's a problem with it. You can't keep them in a cellar
No.
if they're like.
Did they just happen to maybe be in the cellar? Like getting something?
But
I
no, it
this is
was go to like that was their job. It was like go there. It was like they were in charge of organizing party materials, like elves.
I am like a bit aghast at this story. I feel like if I slipped into a dream.
I've never met these people before, and who are they? And they were in the party, right? I mean, if they work here, and like, I just was a bit concerned and bamboozled.
Yeah.
I was like, why have I not met them before if they're full-time organisers? Oh, honestly, the tales I could tell. But yes, very weird. All very weird.
Yeah, super weird.
Super weird.
Yeah. I do think that there's when you set something up like it's the most. And look, I'm not I think individualism is a bit of a dead end. I think we live in a far too individualistic culture. I think that it's if something's worth fighting for, it's worth actually sacrificing for and working for sure. But the total kind of ignoring of people's subjective experiences and even subjectivity altogether is a serious problem.
Well, it's a serious problem, even the fact that they've been so outflanked by post-structuralism.
Yes, yeah, and I think that will be the reason why.
So even if you're concerned about your own project, I am quite a fan of individualism. That's just because I was born and raised in the West, and therefore I'm quite individualistic. When I look at the checklists, I'm like, oh, fully individualistic, not collectivist at all. Okay. But you can't decide that. You are socially constructed by your culture, but I'm against this kind of navel gazing, the constant sort of thinking about the self or thinking that's limitations of everything that we've got to nowadays, particularly on the internet, because it's an individual experience of the internet and it's very individualizing because you're there, it's just one person communicating usually with just one other person. So there we are. Anyway, thank you for listening.
Thanks for this that yeah.
And if you want to support us, we've got a Patreon. And we also have now 38 bonus episodes on there.
Yeah, new ones every Thursday on our Patreon if you're interested.
Sometimes on a Friday or weekend. It's the end of the week. We aim for Thursday, and sometimes it ends up being the end of the week.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, catch you next week.
Catch you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.